LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that have been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Available September 13th at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a whole
thing. Donald Trump went to Mexico and made nice with the country's president. Then he came back to Arizona and gave a speech on immigration that was as hardline as ever. And he said Mexico's going to pay for the wall, whether they know it yet or not. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Leon Krause, news anchor for Univision's Los Angeles affiliate, KMEX. And our special guest is Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Institute. Welcome, everybody. So this was a bizarre week, even by the standards of this bizarre campaign, when we suddenly learned on Tuesday night that Trump was planning to go to Mexico the next day for a surprise bilateral meeting with the country's president. Enrique Peña Nieto received Trump graciously. He did push back on some of Trump's anti-Mexican rhetoric, but he also chalked up some of the angst around Trump to misunderstandings. And though Peña Nieto tweeted hours later that he made clear to Trump that Mexico would not pay for any wall, he declined the opportunity to say so in public at their joint appearance in Mexico City, while Trump said right in front of him that they simply didn't discuss the wall payment, that it was an issue for a later time. Leon, can you help me understand what happened here? Why did this invitation happen, and what did President Peña Nieto think he was going to get out of this meeting?
I can't. it's really almost impossible, Josh, to understand how this happened. First of all, one should say that the Mexican government had the exact opposite strategy for over a year. The Mexican government had been mostly silent for over a year. Peña Nieto had visited Barack Obama fairly recently, had the opportunity to address the wall and Donald Trump as a whole, and he didn't do it. And all of a sudden, he decided it was time to do a complete 180 and invite Trump to Mexico City to welcome him the way he did. Trump hasn't met any head of state, and Peña Nieto said, hey, why not me, the head of a country that you have insulted for over a year? For the Mexican president, it was really a complete disaster. Some people even say it has been a historic disaster. I am of that opinion. He had nothing to gain, no way to win. The only way he could win with Mexican public opinion was if he elicited an apology from Trump of some sort, and that was, well, let's put it this way, highly unlikely. And of course, that didn't happen, and Peña Nieto didn't respond when Trump was on stage next to him in equal footing when it came to who was going to pay for the wall. In Mexico, this has been read as an absolute disaster for Peña Nieto. Very hard to explain and to understand.
It's funny, I mean, because this, most of us in the U.S., I think, have not been paying a lot of attention to domestic Mexican politics previous to this week. And one thing we were seeing in the run-up to this meeting was, well, Peña Nieto has an approval rating of 23% in Mexico, so he's less popular there than Donald Trump is here. Is this why he's so unpopular? Does he do dumb things like this all the time?
Well, yeah, you tweeted that a couple of days ago. Well, yes, that's one of the reasons. But the most important reason is he's been not a very effective president after a set of reforms, very very famously were approved historic reforms in the first 2 years of his presidency. The next 2 years have been a disaster, a faux pas after faux pas. He has been caught in conflict of interest scandals, corruption scandals with his team, even with his wife, public humiliations, and now this sort of confusing decision. Nobody really understands, as I said, what's going on inside his head, inside his team. So it's confusion all around. So a deeply unpopular president, an embattled presidency, is even more so now. And we still have two more years to go. You still have time to delve into Mexican politics. It's fun. It's fun, believe me.
So turning to how this plays in the U.S., it seems to me there were two things Trump was trying to get out of this meeting, and he got them. One was to combat the idea that he's too much of a bigot to be president. And if the president of Mexico can look past Trump's comments about Mexicans, why shouldn't white voters in the United States do so?
Exactly.
The other was to demonstrate that he could do diplomacy on some level, that he could go to a country that he'd been quite hostile toward and be received in a gracious manner and have what appeared to be a civilized, statesman-like conversation. And he did both of those things. I thought that this trip, rather surprisingly, was quite a success for Donald Trump. Mona, do you agree with that?
Well, yes, to a point. But I think that the coverage has been a little overwrought. People have been saying, oh, my heavens, he looked so presidential. He's, you know, and what do they mean by that? He stood at a podium. He did not bite the ankle of the president of Mexico. He maintained a fairly civilized demeanor, more civilized, actually, than he did during the Republican debates. But it was a very, very low bar. And I agree that he cleared it. But I'm not sure that that proves anything at all about his capacity to actually be the president.
Rich, what did you think?
I thought it was a brilliant stroke for Donald Trump. And the way I kind of read it was when Trump was awkwardly standing there during the public availability, that he was as surprised as anyone that he actually managed to pull this off. Because all that Peña Nieto would have had to do to blow the whole thing up is when Trump said that who was going to pay for the wall wasn't discussed, he just could have said, Mr. Trump, no, that's not true. You're lying. You know I told you I wasn't going to pay for the wall. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing would have been a disaster. But for whatever reason, he didn't. And Trump is not losing so much on issues. We've discussed this before. He's losing on demeanor and presidential qualities. So anything he can do to demonstrate that he has such qualities is a good day for him. And there was enormous attention around this trip because of the shock nature of the quick strike nature of it and the fact that he's going to Mexico, of all places. So Peña Nieto gave him arguably the best day of the campaign since Indiana. And I would think 23% approval rating for him is probably a high watermark now in Mexico.
Leon, I know both what you've said and I read your piece,
painful.
You definitely think he humiliated Peña Nieto. Do you think it helped him in the U.S. in addition to causing a lot of pain for Mexico's president?
Well, I think that Trump played the role to perfection. If you saw the whole press conference in which they were on equal footing, Trump chose when and how he wanted to visit Mexico, a country he has insulted for over a year. He established the meeting's agenda. He laid out a five-point plan for the bilateral relationship in the future. He even chose who was going to ask the questions. The president of Mexico was right next to him and just stood there completely silent. So the optics, and Trump is about optics for better or worse, the optics were fantastic for Trump. And I think I completely agree with your assessment, Josh, and with Rich as well. This was a success. He looked presidential, and there have been other politicians in the history of the United States that have benefited from low expectations. I always go back to George W. Bush and Al Gore. Al Gore was supposed to be the brains, and Bush, well, he did pretty well in the debates, low expectations, and well, I think he ended up doing quite well for a couple of electoral cycles.
Well, so then the interesting thing that happened, well, and one of the many interesting things that happened was did this meeting, did the joint appearance, got right back on his plane, went to Arizona for this speech that's been widely discussed. And there's been 2 weeks of discussion leading up to it about whether there's going to be a softening on immigration. Donald Trump repeatedly changing his own messaging, saying there could be a softening, and then saying 2 days later, well, many people are actually saying it's a hardening. And then this speech that he gave in Arizona, I think, was widely received as a continuation of the messaging that he's had on immigration through the primary, hardline in its content and especially in his tone. And the thing I'm personally undecided on is, did that undo whatever good he did for himself during the day in Mexico? If part of the point of the Mexico trip was to show that he could play nice on the world stage, did this undermine it, or did he successfully get two different messages out to two different audiences? Mona, how do you think the speech landed?
He is having it all ways, right? I mean, he's appealing to his base, that is the nationalist, extremely hardcore anti-immigration a part of the Republican Party. He gave them what they like to hear, which is a lot of tone. They don't necessarily, or he doesn't stress content usually, although this speech did have quite a lot of content. But it's really hard to tell, you know, I guess it's a fool's errand to really parse a Donald Trump speech for coherence and consistency on policy. But a number of people bravely did that in any event. And what you find is that it's internally inconsistent. You know, he announces with great flair that that amnesty is over, that all those days are gone. You know, you cannot come here and then go underground and expect to be amnestied in. But then only a few minutes later, he said that after we have this period of securing the border and so on and so forth, then we'll look at the people who are here. Well, wait a minute, they're still here? I thought he said they all had to leave. So it didn't really cohere. What was most noticeable about the speech was, and this is something that he has done consistently throughout his campaign, is that he plays up the America is being victimized by criminal aliens idea, which is wildly exaggerated. Of course, there are some criminal aliens who commit crimes, but he tends to suggest that it's on a par with the risk of terror and other things as being a huge national security problem for the United States, and that it represents a huge percentage of the people who are here illegally. And that is absolutely not true, besides which it is very off-putting to many people who are citizens here.
I think it's worth thinking about this speech in two parts, because it did have a lot more policy content than your typical Donald Trump speech. And it got written up by some people who have been pretty skeptical of Donald Trump in a favorable way. One of them is you, Rich. David Frum wrote a piece saying that he doesn't see what was so shocking about the speech. And I think if you just look bloodlessly at the immigration policy content in the speech, you can make a strong case for that. It's not that different from the platform Mitt Romney ran on 4 years ago. It's ideas that seem like they ought to be within the realm of reasonable debate about immigration. Then there was a lot of this tonal stuff that Mona discusses, especially the framing that we've seen since the beginning of the campaign of immigration principally as an issue of crime and safety and terrorism, that I think a lot of people correctly looked at as inflammatory. So let's, obviously those things relate to each other, but let's take the policy part first. Rich, why don't you make the case that you made in your column this week about why this was a good speech substance-wise?
Well, his policy during the primaries of mass deportation was ridiculous and it was never going to happen. And a lot of the to and froing over the last week and a half was just him trying to figure out how to climb down from that. And I never had any much fear that he was going to come out for a quote-unquote amnesty. I thought this was where he was going to come down, which is basically the common-sense restrictionist agenda that every single policy wonk who is an immigration hawk has been recommending to him for a very long time, which is that you enforce the border, you enforce the laws that we have now, you pass E-Verify to make it harder for illegal immigrants to get a job, then you will see a diminishment of the illegal population. They're not all going to instantly vaporize and disappear. And when you have an enforcement system that you know is going to work, and that if you do an amnesty, you're not going to have a magnet for future flows of illegal immigration, then you deal with the remaining illegal population. And the press really has a real hard time getting its head around this policy. And part of the problem is that Trump's not very good at explaining it. But I think it makes complete sense.
Leon, do you agree with that? Do you think if we set aside all the inflammatory why arguments about why you should do various things on immigration, the what case that Trump made about what to do with immigration, is this something that, even if you don't agree with it, is something that ought to be something that can be reasonably discussed?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I was surprised by the tone and the ferocity of the delivery. And I was also surprised, again, I go back to optics. Rudy Giuliani and Jeff Sessions wearing this strange hat, this white hat that read, "Make Mexico Great Again," also. Look, man, I don't know.
It's all about the Western Hemisphere, Leon. We're all in this together.
I don't know where to start with that hat. On Jeff Sessions, of all people, this year has been just wonderful. But yes, I mean, going back to your question, I agree. It's not that different from Romney's positions. He has, I think he has grown more detailed Of course, this will not endear him in the least with any sort of Hispanic voting bloc, and I think he's going to end up very far from the 27% that Romney had. But I think that he's given up on that already. I don't know what you guys think. I would love to hear your thoughts on that. But I think that he, by now, has given up on appealing to Hispanic voters, or at least a sizable number of them.
We're going to take a quick break and then come back to talking about the tone of the speech. Meanwhile, let us know what you thought at kcrw.com/LRC on our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, more on this. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC. This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Leon Krause, news anchor for Univision's Los Angeles affiliate, KMEX. Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Institute, is also with us. So going back to that speech and the sort of dichotomy between the defensible policy and the very outlandish tone, my view in response to what David wrote about what's so shocking about this content is that the tone is immensely important, and in fact might even be more important than the policy. That basically you've had a candidate out there for a year demonizing immigrants, painting immigrants wildly out of proportion to the crimes that they commit as a threat to safety and national security. And that's not just rude, that it's toxic to the culture and that it's bad for the country. And so I think the question of, you know, why can't people look at these ideas in the speech and say, well, this is, you know, this is all fairly reasonable, is that it's wrapped in this stuff that is very unreasonable and very important. And I guess, Mona, we were talking before the show about you were expressing a desire for people to be able to talk about enforcement in a way that was much less inflammatory than this. I guess my question is, isn't it inflammatory like this because what Trump showed us in the primary was that the deep market for people who care about immigration enforcement are people who want something extremely inflammatory?
Well, that may be true, though I suppose you could have imagined a Republican primary that stressed completely different issues: Obamacare, economic growth, Iran getting the bomb, religious liberty. There are many issues that are important to Republican voters that could have been the focus this year. But it was Trump's particular, Trump and Cruz, their particular obsession with immigration. And so they made it front and center. But they did so, well, certainly Trump did so in the worst possible way. It seems to me that this is a subject that requires a certain amount of finesse, that you have to make clear whenever you are saying that you want to secure the border and that we have to get a handle on illegal immigration. You have to be sure at the very same time to say, but of course we cherish the Hispanic Americans who've made a huge contribution to our society and who are full-fledged Americans, and this is not aimed at any ethnic group. It's simply a matter that any country needs to be sure that its borders are secure and do it that way. If that had been the tone, it would have been a completely different race. You would not see the alienation of Hispanics, you would not, and Asians, and you wouldn't see the nervousness by white suburban women specifically, who find this kind of talk extremely troubling.
The funny thing, though, is Trump does say those things. He talks about how much he loves Mexicans. He employs so many of them. They're fantastic, hardworking people. He loves taco bowls. Part of the problem is that the way that he does that is condescending, is with the taco bowl photo. But I think part of the problem is it's not so much about needing to say certain things. It's about needing to not say certain things. You can't demonize people for a year and then come back and say, oh, just kidding, I love you. That works on The Apprentice. I don't know that it works with the electorate.
Right, but I got to believe you can be emotive on this issue without being demagogic. And that's what Trump constantly is. And everything he touches, he makes crude and exaggerated. And I believe this agenda is common sense, but I recognize how tough it is to sell. Because you are saying, as Trump said in that speech, every illegal immigrant in the country should be subject to deportation. That's going to be threatening to those illegal immigrants. It's going to be threatening to everyone who knows them or is related to them. And I'm all in favor of him highlighting the victims of illegal immigrant crime, as he's done throughout the campaign at various rallies. But at this event, you know, he should have just honed the thing down to like the 10 policy points. And then if he's going to have people on stage, don't do it in a rally setting. First of all, do it at a think tank setting. And then if you're going to have people up with you, say, oh, here's the foreman of my latest construction project who's an immigrant who supports me because he came here the right way and he wants everyone else to as well. And he is just incapable of doing that kind of defensive sort of politics.
Is there an example of someone that you think has made a immigration restriction case that has been emotive without being demagogic?
No, because Mitt Romney is incapable of being emotive, and Donald Trump is incapable of being non-demagogic. I still believe in the abstract. Someone can shoot the middle of that, but no one has yet.
I don't know. Leon,
Romney was very emotional about corporations being people.
Is there any way to sort of put this back in the bottle, Leon? Like, it seems not only that, you know, Trump has said a lot of things that damage the Republican Party with Hispanic voters, but he's sent an important signal that it's not just that they nominated a guy who said all these awful things. It's that they clearly liked that he was saying those awful things. There's a real disconnect, not just with Trump as the candidate, but with a lot of the Republican Party base and the Hispanic community in the United States.
I absolutely agree. I mean, as far as I know, Donald Trump is a Republican candidate for president. So the things he said resonated with, a considerable segment of the Republican voting base. I mean, is there a way of putting this back in the bottle? I think that there wasn't a way of doing so even from the very beginning. I mean, Trump really set the bar very, very high with that first appearance over a year ago. And this mixed martial artist sort of delivery that's still going on, and we saw it at the rally in Arizona. I mean, when he says, "Are you ready?" What kind of thing is that? I mean, he was going to announce a detailed plan on immigration, and he was just like trying to incite the crowd and build things up. It plays poorly, and when you add the faces that for Hispanics are very well known and very hurtful, like Joe Arpaio, who was there saying that the trip to Mexico was very successful. Jeff Sessions is lesser known, but those of us who do know him know how big of an opponent he has been of immigration reform. Giuliani and his new tone. Just the whole combination is beyond repair.
We haven't mentioned the Democrats. The Democratic Party's position now seems to be just get your foot across the border and you are immediately entitled to everything, including citizenship. So they are truly radical in their approach. And if it prevails, it will be because the Republican Party blew it so badly.
I think that's a little bit of an overstatement, but I don't think it's necessarily a lot of an overstatement. There has been this enormous move leftward first by President Obama and now by Hillary Clinton on immigration, and there has been this idea that has taken hold in the Democratic Party that unless somebody has committed some other crime, that it is unreasonable to deport them simply for lacking authorization to be in the country. And I think that, you know, in a more normal election, that could be a liability for Democrats.
They treat it as some sort of civil rights violation.
And maybe, so to Rich's point about what's setting the restrictionists back, I guess maybe if there is overreach from the left, once Trump is out of the picture and people are more focused on what President Hillary Clinton is doing on this, then that might be your way back in, although I'm not sure. I think that, in fact, Trump has given an enormous opening for just a much more liberal immigration policy. I want to talk quickly about one of the sillier moments this week. Marco Gutierrez, the head of the group Latinos for Trump, went on MSNBC on Thursday and warned that his culture is very dominant and imposing, and that if you don't do something about it, there's going to be taco trucks on every corner. And people have been laughing about this because people love tacos, and a convenient taco truck sounds great to people with all sorts of opinions about immigration. But I think in a weird way, this was actually getting at something, which is that when we talk about immigration, we talk about jobs, and we talk about crime, and we talk about fiscal costs. But I don't think the politics of immigration are principally about any of those things. It's just a sense that people feel like they're being surrounded by people from a foreign culture, and they don't like it. And so I think, you know, we laugh at this statement because it was stupid, but I think we sort of laugh at it at our peril, because I think it gets at something that really is driving a lot of the Trump phenomenon, that there are just a lot of white people in America who feel like their culture is being diluted, and they don't like it, and they can't express that sentiment directly because it's kind of bigoted. But that's at the core of the feeling.
I completely agree with you. I think obviously there's a cultural and even demographic anxiety to the Trump movement. As for Marco Gutierrez, I interviewed him during the Republican convention. He was there, thrilled to be there. And I found him to be, as many Hispanics who plan to vote for Trump, certainly conflicted between supporting a candidate like him, like Trump, and reflecting on his own identity and the plight of his parents and his childhood. A conflicted individual, but I agree, he has brought to the fore, even if it was strange, because I think we all love tacos and taco trucks on every corner, it doesn't sound so horrible, a big part of what's driving Trump's appeal with at least part of his voters.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
All honor to the University of Chicago, which sent a letter to incoming freshmen telling them that there won't be trigger warnings or safe spaces, and that school encourages people to speak, write, listen, challenge, and learn without fear of censorship. It's welcome evidence that not everyone in higher education has lost their mind.
Leon Krause.
Well, today I want to suggest our listeners go to iTunes and download some music by the great Juan Gabriel. And Josh, since I'm sitting here in Santa Monica, I hijacked the board, and let's play a little something from Juan Gabriel.
Pero qué necesidad, para qué tanto problema, no hay como la libertad de ser, de estar, de ir, de amar, de hacer, de hablar, de andar, así sin penas.
Taco trucks on every corner and Juan Gabriel music on every corner. So there you go, a complete original.
I didn't know we could have musical accompaniments to our rants.
Well, that's the advantage I have working with our producer right next to me. So please listen to Juan Gabriel. This guy was a complete original. He was a festive, joyous musician, a cultural trailblazer. He changed Mexican popular music. I could really go on and on. It's a brief rant, but listen to Juan Gabriel and you'll smile. We need smiles, certainly.
Mona Sharon.
I, too, have a university on my list, but it's not for a good reason. It's Georgetown University. They recently discovered that two of the early owners, founders of the university, had engaged in selling human beings, selling slaves. And so they're trying to repair the damage. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, and they have programs, and that's all fine. But they did say that one of the ways they're going to do this is by giving an admissions advantage to students who are descendants of the slaves who were sold. Now, it's impossible to do historical restitution. I mean, after all these generations have passed, it's impossible to know whether they might be favoring a student who was a descendant of a slave and possibly also of a slave owner. Who knows? And they might be harming someone whose ancestors ran the Underground Railroad or died in the Civil War fighting slavery, or many other possibilities come to mind. The whole idea that we can confer benefits on present people to compensate for age-old crimes or slights is mistaken and the wrong way to go.
For my rant, we're taping this on September 2nd, and early fall is approaching here in New York. I'm really excited for fall. There's going to be foliage and apple cider and apple picking and maybe a pumpkin spice latte or two. But mostly I'm excited because the election will be in the fall, less than 10 weeks from now. And that means that our year-and-a-half-long national nightmare is very close to being over. I am extremely excited about that. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Rich Lowry, Leon Krause, and Mona Charon. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Ashleen Knutson is our production assistant, and this is her last week as our production assistant. She's moving on to bigger and better things. Thank you so much for all of your help, Ashleen. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.